Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting.
Paul Summers, who normally does the intros to Clearly Quaker podcast, was interviewed for this episode. In this podcast, Paul talks about his rich Quaker family history, his thoughts on Quakerism, and his experiences as a Quaker during the Vietnam War. Paul is a member of Greenwich Monthly Meeting, clerk of the Salem Quarter Steering Committee, and clerk of the Fellowship of Quakers in the Arts South Jersey Chapter. Paul is a classical composer who owns and operates Morris River Press, a music publication company, and he co-hosts Your Classical Coffee Break podcast, which is available on iTunes.
There was back in the 1600s, I'm not sure exactly when one of the John Summers, there are many John Summers, but when one of them married, he'd been involved in the Civil War, I believe on the Cavalier side, but I'm not even sure about that. But he had had it with war, and he wished to put down his sword, as it were, and join the Quakers, because for one thing, even way back then, they were a peace church. So that was in there. And then his son, another John Summers, was married a Quaker woman, just as his father had. And then he and his wife and a child decided to come to America to join William Penn in 1683, I believe that was. In fact, I know it was. That's when they arrived. And except that his wife and child had died on the passage, which was terrible, but not all that unusual, I guess. But anyway, he landed in the Philadelphia area, probably in Burlington first. Actually, Penn settled in Burlington before he settled in Philadelphia, in New Jersey. But in any case, he became a member of what is now, I guess, Abington Meeting. And there he met someone else and got married and had children by her over here. And that was in 1683. And then in 1693, he bought a gigantic parcel of land from a Quaker named William Budd. And that parcel of land included what is modern day, I'll use the modern day terms, Ocean City, which is Peck's Beach, Summers Point, obviously coming from his name, although what he called it all was Somerset Plantation. But in any case, Summers Point, Linwood, Northfield, and much of the land stretching up the eastern and northern side up to Mays Landing. So he owned all that land. It was all a Quaker plantation, as it were. But it was very wild. It was described as being wilderness by traveling Quaker preachers who would go around and visit Quaker families or congregations or meetings, I should say, really. And it was just, you know, when you had somebody even in the 1700s coming through there, 1720s, for instance, there was a person with a minute of travel from Haverford Meeting, I believe, who came into southern New Jersey, and he just described coming into the meeting with that Summers had as being, it was practically, I think he did use the word wilderness. It was just empty. It was not empty. It was farming and doing all the term plantation meant self-sufficient. That it was an outfit that could take care of itself. Didn't have to go outside very much for any of its needs. So anyway, he ran that. And then his son, I believe, in 1727 built what is even now one of the a historic building owned by the state of New Jersey, which is called the Summers Mansion. And it's in Summers Point. It's up on a sort of a promontory where there used to be a traffic circle. Now there's just a major, it's where the 9th Street Bridge from Ocean City comes over. And right when you come over into Summers Point, there's this old building, two-story brick building sitting up there with a very prominent second floor, because they were all sailors. They had boats. They depended on sailing to get them from place to place, and to get whatever they produced as far away as the Caribbean. So the second floor was great for looking out over the sandbar, which is now Ocean City. Back then it was just a big sandbar, and you could see boats coming and going and keeping track of the sailing traffic around there. But anyway, the grandson, John, who built the house, meeting took place in what is now called the Summers Mansion. And in fact, that's where the word manse came from. A manse was always where pastors or a church group lived. So that's what the term mansion actually at some point came from, at least here in this use. So it goes back quite a while, and Summers maintained their Quaker connections, and meeting took place in the Summers Mansion until the Revolution, the American Revolution, when several of the members of the direct descendants of the original John, the founder John, felt that they were called to be part of the military operation. And of course, Quakers would not bear arms. And so several members of the family decided to leave meeting. They were probably somewhat read out, but you know, my sense is, from things that I know about it, that this was not a black and white issue, that there was a lot of consideration. I mean, the owner of the house left meeting to become a military person in the Revolution, and yet he encouraged and allowed the remaining friends to continue to meet in the Summers Mansion, where he lived. So there was a great affection he had for meeting, but he had this one thing that was in the way. And so it was just a really interesting thing just to consider, that things were not black and white, and that this was there were some real considerations and ambivalence even about it. This did not prevent him from becoming one of the most successful privateers on the colonial cause, but it was certainly not a Quakerish thing to do. But nevertheless, meeting continued in his house. And most people, many Quakers in southern New Jersey at least, who left because of the Revolution, joined the Methodist Church, because the Methodist Church's history was one of being the first denomination actually started in America. The early Methodists were actually Church of England, and John Wesley, who founded Methodism, was a Church of England priest. And he encouraged the Methodists who were over here to not leave the English crown, to remain loyal, to continue to be Church of England. And the bishops, the different circuit riders he had in America all said, "No, John, you don't have it right. We need to be separate." And so Methodism began actually by breaking away from John Wesley because of the American Revolution, and everybody knew it at that time. And so it became a very pro-colonial cause, and many people who were Quakers and other things who decided to leave left to become Methodists. And I indeed, after decades, centuries of Methodism as being what our family did, and I'm the one who then finally, it's an interesting story how I came to come back to Quakerism. But anyway, that was in about 1958 or 1959. I think probably 1959. I'm not exactly sure. It's one of those 2 years. All I know is I had to be able to drive. And I think I could have driven by the fall of 58. So any case, but it, so it was that then or 59. Now how that happened was I was raised in a very lovely, interesting, very liberal Methodist church in Westfield, New Jersey, which is not too far from a Methodist seminary, Drew Seminary, up in Madison. They used to have regular lecture series by professors at the seminary. And one of them, a fellow named Lawrence Toombs, came down and gave a lecture at the church where I was attending, and where I was born and raised, right in that church. I was baptized there and all this. And in it, he had some very good words about Quakers in this lecture. I'm not even sure what the topic was. I think that it had to do with speaking speaking truth to power, because I know he was very big on only affirming, not swearing, and talked about some court cases which were in the New Jersey courts at the time, which had to do with such issues. But in any case, afterwards I came up and told him that I had a family that had arrived as Quakers. And he said, well, you ever been to meeting? And I said, no. And he said, okay. He looked me right in the eye and said, I want you to be at meeting on next Sunday. This is on a Wednesday night. And he said, the closest meeting is in Plainfield. And he told me where it was in Plainfield. And he told me when they met and said, I really think you better be there. He didn't just say, you might want to go. Or he said, I think you better be there. It was really wonderful. And I said, yes, sir. And I went. I mean, I was able to drive, so I drove over. I got my parents' permission to use the car to drive over there. They were okay with this, mind you. They were very active in the Methodist Church, and so was I. But they said, "This, I think you ought to do it." So I went over, and I'm going to tell you, it was like coming home. I knew nothing about it, but I stepped foot and realized this was what I really wanted. And it was the idea of silence. It was the idea of being thoughtful. It was also the idea of not being told something by a pastor or whatever. And that, boy, did that speak to me. And it still does. You know, it was one of those things. I get it. I know what I get this. And so then it just grew from there. Now, it didn't mean I didn't keep going to a Methodist church. My family did. But then as soon as I went off to college, and I went up in Ithaca, Ithaca College, because they have a great music conservatory there. And I began going to a friends meeting in Ithaca, which was over at Cornell in those days. Now it's not. Now it's downtown. They have an actual meeting house. But... back in the 60s, it was held in a room in the Religious Life Center there, Annabelle Taylor Hall at Cornell. And so it was not at all like these lovely old historic buildings. It was just like a meeting room in a big, in a big stone edifice at Cornell, that's all. I think a Quaker is one who understands that holding something in the light, particularly inside oneself, is a matter of looking for the strength that's within oneself. And understanding that same possibility is within everyone. And that gives everyone value. That gives everyone a person who, as being someone who has that ability to go beyond themselves to a certain degree. I think it comes out to my feeling about what God is, because I do not believe in supernatural God at all. I don't believe in magic. If I really believed in magic, I would not be amused and have fun at a magician's show. I would be in awe, and I would feel that there was something actually supernatural taking place. You know, but anyway, I do not believe in the supernatural at all. For me, God is, here's what happens. When you have a group, it's often said that a good tight-knit group has something that's more than the sum of its parts. And for me, it's that extra that is the more than the sum of the parts that equals God. So each group, in a sense, has created its own God. So I'm a polytheist, in a sense, that every group, but it doesn't have to be a religious group. I mean, you know, Boy Scouts and a good close-knit group of people who go bowling even every week or something. But in that group, there is something that makes their fellowship more than just them. It's something that is the addition of all of who they are together. And then there's something that is an added spirit within that. And I say that that is God. So when I see that everybody has that capacity to be part of that, to have that within them, to be somebody who would add something that would be more than the sum of its parts to a fellowship, even to one other person, then there's something very, I might even use the word holy about that. And that's to be revered, and that's to be protected, and to be encouraged. And how could I want to do violence to that person? So that's where that is for me. That's a big part of Quakers. And another part of Quakers is, in fact, the fellowship. I think that's true about any religious group. I think it's true about many groups that wouldn't even consider themselves to be religious. As I said, you know, clubs and so on can be that way. But certainly the Quakers, that part of the texture of their fellowship is the silence. And having not just pure sort of, how should I say, an introverted meditation as being what worship is, a silent worship, is actually a very active silence. It's something that you're sharing with everyone else who's in silence. And if somebody then does decide to speak, to have some spoken ministry in the meeting, which is something that happens, that it comes out of not meditation so much as it is of actively working on something, actively holding something in the light within you. It's a matter of being not a passive thing, but a very, exactly the opposite, very active, very inquiring thing. And that leads me to the thing which for me is the hallmark of Quakerism, what sets Quakers apart. And that is that Quakers do not have creeds. You'll never find a statement of "we believe this." There is no credo for Quakers. What Quakers have is queries. And these are queries which each yearly meeting tends to publish their own set. They're pretty much the same thing, but they can differ in words and in numbers, and in how they're phrased and so on. But we have queries which are asked not with a set answer, but with the idea to prompt one to go within and see what, and find out what your answer is today and ask what it is and answer it tomorrow and the day after and the day after. It's an ongoing process, and your answer may change. It may change as circumstances bend how you're thinking. Myself, this is just me, but I have drawn a distinction between belief and faith. To me, belief is coming up with a hard, fast, this is what I believe, and it gets stuck in the ground. This is it. Whereas faith is more of a process in which you are within an ongoing conversation, an ongoing set of queries that you're always asking yourself all the time. It's the way for me that you get through what is the chaos of the world, of the universe. Because in the midst of chaos, belief is almost always going to be a victim. But if you're just always in the faith action of queries, those can change, not in a sense of weakness, but in a sense of taking charge of the situation, yourself, and finding out what the community would hold dear and what your part in the community is. That's one of the things that I love about friends meeting for business. It's actually officially called meeting for worship with an attention to business. Now, I happen to be the clerk of the steering committee for our quarter. And one of the few things that I actually control as a clerk is the amount of silence that we have at the beginning of a meeting and at the end. I think it's important to understand that even a business meeting or a steering committee meeting, which is a kind of business meeting, grows out of and subsides into Quaker silence. And one of the great differences when there's meeting for business, if it's in my estimation, a well-clerked meeting, if there is contention, if there are disagreements, strong disagreements, where in some committees, in some groups, you'd end up with people yelling or pounding fists or whatever. If it gets to that kind of point, then as a clerk, I would say, I think we should now settle in and have some silence. Let's go back inside and begin to consider what's going on. I've never had to do it, but that's exactly what I would do. I've seen it done, which is how I know that would be the effective way. There were times in Ithaca back in the 60s, with the war going on, that there would be a lot of strong feelings about how to deal with that. And sometimes a meeting would get people kind of getting a little, well, excited, shall we say. And the clerk would say, let's settle in for a while. And that would calm it down. And then after a while, and I mean 10, 15 minutes, the clerk would say, welcome back to our meeting. And that's all. And then what was going to be said was said, but it was calmed down. And it was now after everybody having absorbed what happened and treated it in the strength of silence, rather than everybody digging themselves further and further into their own little hole of belief, what they believed about a situation. Get belief out of it and get the light being shown on it so you can examine it. Don't believe in it, examine it. It's so powerful to learn and to experience. I think it's no surprise that I might feel that way. I'm the only person in my family, and it turns out even in my wife's family, who is not either an engineer or a scientist. And what are they're all about asking questions or answering questions, but not with belief, which is something which may or may not have a good foundation, but of what actually works empirically, or the question, which is a hypothesis. And so it's, there's no magic about it. And so let's consider this. Now, how can we deal with it in a very sober, calm way? And I think that in an odd way that, not an odd way, it's actually a very effective way, that Quakerism in a real sense matches in a spiritual way the life of somebody in a lab or somebody at a design board, like an engineer perhaps. I mean, I could give the list of what my family did. My father was a well-known mechanical engineer. My brother's an electrical engineer who helped develop digital photography. My son's a physicist. I mean, you know, and they all have a certain set of things that are very empirical for them. It's all experience, and that's the way Quakers are in a more spiritual sense. There's the wonderful old apocryphal, I'm sure, tale about Herbert Hoover, our president, who was, of course, a Quaker. And he and one of his friends were riding along somewhere out in the country, and the friend said, "Oh, what a lovely herd of brown cows." And Hoover said, "Well, at least on this side, the side we can see." And it's to illustrate that I only know what I can see and what I can experience. Who knows? These cows turned around, why they might be spotted on that side. Well, of course, it's a joke intended that way, but yet the kernel of one kind of Quaker truth is in it. It's an experiential religion. It's what is it that works that I can experience when I hold up my life, my experiences to the light, what do I discover? Now, mind you, I was already very busy being a Quaker, and I was a conscientious objector, and discovered, because there was a wonderful support service back in those days for conscientious objectors, and it was in New York State, and of course I think it was in New York, they put out a list of jobs that historically had been held as being appropriate for conscientious objector alternative service. And I got the book, the pamphlet, well, I don't know, sort of, it was a pamphlet that listed all the jobs that historically had been taken. And I looked at one and it said, Cornell University Library. I said, whoa, that's different. And it's right here in town. I was living in Ithaca, 512 Farm Street. I even remember that. Anyway, and so I called up Cornell and said, explained what I wanted. I mean, I told him it was alternative service and so on. And the person said, "Well, do you have any language skills?" I said, "Yeah, I speak German. Can you come up and interview tomorrow?" And I was at work at Cornell a week later. They had a whole project that involved German, and I did it for 2.5 years, which is beyond what you had to do for alternative service, but I wanted to see the project through. So anyway, that's how I came to end up in Ithaca even longer than my college years. Now, when I began working at Cornell, it was easier to be actually in Friends because they met at Cornell. Previously, I'd been going to Ithaca College, and that was in a whole different area of town. And it was difficult, but I'd still get up there. Now, here's one thing that happened, was that a lot of us were concerned that people didn't understand the effects of war on the native population of Vietnam, the people who were Vietnamese, that war devastated their food supply. Now, at that time, the Students for Democratic, what was it, Society? SDS is what it was, initials were. They were a pretty vocal group. They'd have meetings up on the Quad. And we wanted to do something that wouldn't be so noisy and not maybe quite so controversial in a sense. I mean, SDS was looking to polarize. We just wanted to put some simple things out there, like, here's what's happening to Vietnamese people. And that was it. And after some real consideration, some silence, and talking very simply, we determined that we would, a bunch of us, take on the discipline of eating the diet that a Vietnamese peasant would have, and that we would do that even in our non-public times, but that we would do it publicly at lunchtime in the big dining hall in Willard Straight Hall, which is sort of like the student union at Cornell, and that we would not only do it there, but that we would do it in Quaker silence, sitting at one table. And that if somebody asked what we were up to, then answer in very few words, and then relapse into silence. We had one table. We did this for 2 weeks. We all really kept it. I never ate a bit of food for breakfast before I came, or for dinner after I was gone. Either. It was my discipline. I kept it. And I'm sure that everyone else did too. The only difference from what a Vietnamese peasant would have eaten was perhaps the quality of the rice, but also that a doctor insisted that we must have some orange juice every day. Otherwise we'd become really ill because we wouldn't be used to that kind of a diet. And so we did go along with that. Now, all I can say is that we held to that discipline of being silent and only speaking if asked directly by somebody, what are you up to? And we would answer in very few words. It was extraordinarily dramatic that it was silent. It was also extraordinarily dramatic what we were doing, and that we were doing it all together. By the end of the 2 weeks that we had committed to, we had three tables full people who had joined us, some of whom remained Quakers then, but people who said, this I can join in with. And they sat, they took on our discipline, and whether they did or not for breakfast and dinner, it wasn't the point. And I think most of them did actually. But here was two big tables worth of people sitting in silence and saying, this is what war has caused. It wasn't saying, fight the war. It wasn't being against anything, although it was. It was being against hunger. It was non-political. It just said, this is something that we care about because of what it's doing to people. Later, and I'm sure this was something that happened over, well, I know it happened over a much wider group of Quakers than just an Ithaca meeting, but it came to our attention that medical supplies, which went into the hands of the American Red Cross to be sent to Vietnam, would only be used for American or South Vietnamese troops. or people in the area controlled by them. And we felt that medical supplies should be nonpartisan. It also became apparent that most other, at least the Canadians, Red Cross, did not make that political distinction, that anybody who needed the supplies that the Canadian Red Cross had would get them. Didn't matter whether they were North Vietnamese, whether they were part of the army or just a civilian or whatever, as well as, of course, you know, the Canadian and American troops and so on. And that we decided we wanted to give to the Red Cross, but that we wanted to give to this Canadian Red Cross. So we set up a gigantic line. This took a real coordination. I mean, so this was many, many meetings across the southern tier and up into the Great Lakes area, up to the Ontario area, Rochester and so on. Anyway, we all assembled, and there was a gigantic truck filled with medical supplies on the American side, and we had it pull up near the Peace Bridge in Niagara Falls that leads over to Canada. And we set up two lines, I believe, passing goods, one to the other, silently passing, and it went over the bridge, passing on the chain of people, over the bridge to Canadians, who then silently passed it down to a truck belonging to the Canadian Red Cross. And it was the silence that was mentioned almost immediately in newspaper account of it. How striking it was. This was like an activity of meeting. It's like we were having meeting in the cafeteria. It was like we had meeting passing goods on. Very powerful, because of the silence, because of that distinctively Quaker attitude. It's still part of me. So now I'll tell you something else that happened once. Now, in the room that we used for meeting in Wildstrake Hall at Cornell at the time, it was built into the side of a hill. I mean, if you know Ithaca, it is nothing but, I mean, it is hills. So you came in, and the meeting we're in just had one window that was way up high on the wall, and it was in one of those wells that you have that puts it right below ground level, but somebody has some plants and so on in there. And one spring, first day, we were having a meeting, and oh, it was a noisy meeting. Barely on the edge of what we really Quakers would want. It was all because of the war. It was right after there had been some particular bombing mission that had taken place, which made the news. I'm not sure which one. And it was going on. And people were standing up. And there wouldn't be 3 minutes until somebody stood up and said something else. And some of them would be pretty overheated and maybe a little louder than might usually happen in a friends meeting. And then, I hesitate to use the word old lady, because she was probably younger than I am now, but it does seem that the people with some age at least have a little... And all these people standing up and being upset. And then this one woman stood up and she said, "From where I'm sitting, I can see the daffodils blooming outside through our one window. And I'm reminded that the rest of the church-type world today is celebrating Easter. Let's just remember that." She sat down and there wasn't another word spoken all morning. It was such a Quaker moment. "Let's consider," said she, in essence, "what else is in this world right now?" And it was an astonishing moment I'll never forget. Because it really, well, like I said, it was an exceptionally Quaker moment, as were all those other two things I described. But that's the kind of thing that happened often in friends' meetings. I've seen things like that happen even without wars going on. But the special moments that come out of the silence. So for me, it's the silence. When I come to these old meeting houses, sometimes if I'm early or if it's not many in attendance, that can happen in these very rural meetings here sometimes. Very few people might come. I'll sit in silence, and I myself find myself having meeting with the spirits of all those who once sat here. I think back to my Quaker ancestors, and I place them into a meeting house that I'm in sometimes and just think, what were you saying? What were you thinking? What were you finding in the inner light? What struggles were you having and that you got through because you were in meeting and grappling with things, grappling with the issues that were facing you? That's what the meeting is about. It's not just peace. It's finding peace in yourself by grappling with the issues you have. You'll never have peace if you don't grapple. They say you have to fight for peace. It doesn't mean fighting physically. It means you've got to fight in here. You've got to find where the peace is. You hold the light to that.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.